All right, ready to jump into another deep dive. This time, we're taking a look at a case that'll really make you think about jurisdiction and counterclaims in federal court. It's United States v. Hayward Robinson Company, a 1970 case from the Second Circuit.
Yeah, it's a fascinating one for sure.
Definitely. So think construction projects, the Navy, and a private company. Sounds like a recipe for a legal puzzle, right?
Absolutely. And this case really shows how a seemingly straightforward dispute can become incredibly complex when you start dealing with these overlapping jurisdictions.
So we've got two construction projects in Connecticut at the heart of it all. One for the Navy, which is obviously federal territory.
Right.
And another one for a private company called Stelma. Now, on the surface, that seems pretty far removed from federal court.
You'd think so, but here's the catch. Both of these projects were being handled by the same prime contractor, Hayward Robinson.
Okay.
And the same subcontractor, D'Agostino Excavators. And that's where things start to get interesting.
All right, so let's get into the nitty-gritty here. What was the initial issue that sparked this whole legal battle?
So D'Agostino sued Hayward Robinson in federal court. They were seeking payment for, you guessed it, the Navy project.
Okay, makes sense.
And they specifically sued under the Miller Act.
Ah, the Miller Act. For our listeners who might not be familiar, can you quickly explain what that is?
Sure. It's a federal law that's designed to protect subcontractors who are working on federal construction projects.
Right, so that makes sense why D'Agostino had a direct path to federal court.
Exactly.
But how on earth did that private Stelma project end up in this federal court showdown? That's what I don't get.
Well, that's where things take a turn. Hayward Robinson, they didn't just sit back. They countersued. And not only for alleged overpayments on the Navy project.
Uh-oh.
They also threw in a counterclaim related to that Stelma project, claiming D'Agostino had been overpaid there as well.
Now, I'm sure our listeners are thinking the same thing I am right now. How can a federal court even touch that Stelma claim? It's a private project. It has absolutely nothing to do with the federal government or the Miller Act, for that matter.
You've hit the nail on the head. That's the big question here. And it brings us to this concept of ancillary jurisdiction.
Ancillary jurisdiction.
Yeah, basically, this allows federal courts to rule on non-federal claims if they're closely connected to that core federal claim.
So the Navy project claims is like the anchor pulling in this state claim related to Stelma.
Exactly. But it's not enough for the claims to just be, you know, vaguely related.
Right.
They really need to be tightly connected. And that's where the distinction between what we call compulsory and permissive counterclaims comes in. And this can get a little technical, but it's important for understanding how this all works.
All right. Well, let's break it down then. What are these different types of counterclaims and how do they impact jurisdiction?
Okay. So think of a compulsory counterclaim, and this is defined in Rule 13A of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure.
Mm-hmm.
A compulsory counterclaim basically must be heard by the same court because it arises from the same set of facts as the original claim. They're so intertwined that they practically have to be resolved together.
So a compulsory counterclaim is like two sides of the same coin. You can't really separate them.
Right.
But what about producive counterclaims? Are they just kind of tagging along?
They're a little different. They may be heard by the same court, but they don't absolutely have to be.
Okay.
They might be related to that main claim in some way, but not so inextricably linked that they must be resolved together.
Gotcha. So where did the Second Circuit land on that Stelma counterclaim? Was it a must-have or a nice-to-have?
They decided it was a must-have. They considered it compulsory, meaning it was so entangled with that Navy project claim that it had to be heard in federal court.
Entangled, you say? How so? What made the court decide that these two projects were that interconnected?
It really came down to the details of the contracts. For example, both contracts had this clause allowing Hayward Robinson to terminate both projects if either was breached.
Wow.
So that right there shows a pretty strong link between them, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, definitely.
And there was more than just that termination clause. Payments for both projects were often made in like combined lump sums.
Oh, wow.
And a single insurance policy covered both projects. So all these factors sort of painted this picture of two projects that were just really deeply intertwined, legally and practically.
So the court wasn't just trying to be, you know, convenient or anything. They were really looking at the actual contracts and the real-world connections between the projects. It makes sense when you lay it out like that. But let's circle back to that logical relationship test you mentioned before. It sounds like that's how courts figure out if a counterclaim is compulsory, right?
Yeah, exactly. The logical relationship test isn't just about finding like a random connection between claims.
Right.
It's about whether they share the same factual background, real overlap in the evidence, and legal issues that need to be considered.
So basically, the court was saying in order to figure out the Navy project dispute, you had to look at what was happening with the Stelma project, too.
Exactly. Imagine trying to resolve the payment dispute on just the Navy project without looking at those combined contracts, the lump sum payments, and the possibility that maybe overpayment on one could offset underpayment on the other. It'd be like trying to do a puzzle with half the pieces missing.
That's a really good way to put it. Makes it much clearer why the court saw those claims as, well, inseparable. But what if the counterclaim had been about something totally different? Like, I don't know, say Hayward Robinson had countersued D'Agostino for a breach of, like, a landscaping contract.
That's an interesting what if, and it kind of shows the limits of that logical relationship test. A landscaping contract, assuming it's got nothing to do with these construction projects or contracts, wouldn't pass that test.
Right.
It wouldn't have that shared factual background or the legal and practical connection we see in Hayward Robinson.
So that hypothetical landscaping counterclaim would probably be permissive, not compulsory. And it wouldn't just automatically be under federal jurisdiction. That's helpful. It really shows how the logical relationship test works in action. But hold on. Before we move on, I got to ask about Judge Friendly's dissenting opinion. He agreed about federal jurisdiction, but didn't think the Stelma counterclaim was compulsory. What's up with that?
Judge Friendly's dissent is really interesting. It shows this sort of tension in the legal system between efficiency and sticking to traditional jurisdictional boundaries.
Okay.
He argued that the Stelma counterclaim wasn't compulsory because it didn't come from the exact same transaction or occurrence as that Miller Act claim.
Interesting.
But he still thought the federal court had jurisdiction, suggesting that maybe the old rules about these permissive counterclaims need a refresh.
So he was basically saying, hey, everyone's already here in federal court. Let's just figure everything out at once instead of making it more complicated and forcing everyone to go back and forth between state and federal court.
Yeah, pretty much. Judge Friendly was worried about, you know, wasting time and resources if there had to be a separate basis for jurisdiction over permissive counterclaims in a case like this. He was thinking about the bigger picture and wanted a more practical approach.
Yeah, his dissent definitely makes you think about the whole purpose of jurisdiction. And the balance between sticking to the rules and making things actually work in practice?
It's a classic debate, right? Should we follow the rules even when they cause our problems? Or should we be more flexible to make sure things are fair? Judge Friendly's view is interesting because it kind of predicts this bigger trend in law towards simplifying complicated litigation and avoiding unnecessary procedural hurdles.
That's a good point. So United States v. Hayward Robinson Company isn't just an old case. It's something that lawyers and judges are still grappling with today. These issues of jurisdiction, efficiency, and fairness are still relevant. It sounds like United States v. Hayward Robinson Company is a case that every lawyer should know about, especially if they're dealing with, you know, complicated deals or multiple contracts. What are some of the big takeaways here? What should our listeners remember?
Oh, there's a lot to learn from this case. I mean, first off, it really emphasizes how important strategy is when it comes to counterclaims. Lawyers need to really analyze the connections between claims and understand how jurisdiction might be affected by each move they make. A smart counterclaim can be a really powerful tool, but if it's done at the wrong time or categorized incorrectly, it can really backfire.
So it's not enough to just react to what the other side is doing. You got to be proactive and think a few steps ahead.
Exactly. And if you're in a situation with, like, connected contracts or a bunch of related transactions, you need to keep that logical relationship test in mind from the very beginning.
Right.
Because if you don't bring up a compulsory counterclaim early enough, you might lose your chance to even have it heard.
That makes sense. And this all goes back to why it's so important to write clear and concise contracts. Like, if those contracts for the Navy and Stelma projects had been more specific about what was separate and what was connected, maybe this whole jurisdictional mess could have been avoided.
Oh, absolutely. This case really shows that the words you use in contracts have consequences in the real world. When you're drafting amendments, especially with multiple parties or projects, you have to think about how a court might interpret them. Ambiguity just leads to more problems down the line.
So it's about thinking ahead, anticipating those potential disputes, and writing contracts that minimize the risk of ending up in a jurisdictional nightmare.
It's preventative lawyering. Clear contracts save everyone time, money, and headaches later on.
Definitely. This case also shows a bigger trend in the legal system, a push towards being more efficient and streamlining things. Courts don't want to waste time on unnecessary procedures, and they definitely don't want parties going back and forth between state and federal court if it can all be settled in one place.
Yeah. United States v. Hayward Robinson Company shows how judges try to find a balance between following the rules about jurisdiction and also needing to resolve things fairly and efficiently. Judge Friendly's dissent, in particular, shows that sometimes you need to be more flexible to get a fair outcome.
It's a good reminder that the law isn't just about rules and abstract ideas. It's about finding solutions to real problems and making sure the justice system works for everyone.
Well said. United States v. Hayward Robinson Company is a case that people are still talking about today, and it influences legal strategy. It's definitely worth a read for anyone who wants to understand how jurisdiction works, what counterclaims are, and how the way we handle lawsuits is changing.
Well, thanks for joining us for this deep dive into United States v. Hayward Robinson Company. We hope you learned something interesting. See you next time. EEIE.